Kia ora, welcome to episode 23 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit Emily Wolfe at Melanie Roger Gallery in Tamaki Makaurau while she was in Aotearoa for the opening of her show Long Distance. Emily graduated with a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the Elam School of Fine Arts at the University of Auckland in 1996, then completed her Master of Fine Arts at the Slade School of Fine Art, University College, London, graduating in 2000. Emily has exhibited consistently since then with over 20 solo shows to her name. She has several awards and residencies throughout the United Kingdom and is held in numerous public and private collections, including the University of Auckland Art Collection. Emily is represented by Melanie Roger Gallery in Auckland, Tamaki Makaurau, Page Galleries in Te Whanganui Atara, Wellington, and Benjamin Parsons in Oxford in the United Kingdom. There are images of the paintings that we talk about on the Good Oil Emily Wolfe Instagram post for your reference. You'll hear Emily talk about never being sure if a painting is going to work out, the hope that she'll one day get better as a painter, spending too much time inside, including not being able to bring yourself to leave the studio to join Don Binney's outdoor landscape class at Elam, the importance of imperfection in subject matter, the parallels she found in the layers of London clay and time as an archaeologist and the layers of paint as a painter, and the joy she's discovered in dehumidifiers. We started by talking about memories of growing up in a house full of the presence of art.
So when I was really small, I remember being at home, you know, Mum had a studio in the house, so I would, you know, wander in and out. She'd be trying to work and I would be probably distracting her. Yeah, it just was...
It's in your DNA.
Well, it's just there. There's always a memory of it,
yeah.
Is what I'm saying.
I should mention here that your parents, Richard and Pamela Wolfe, so your mum, a painter in her own right, and Richard, you know, has written I don't know how many New Zealand art books, but
lots and lots.
More than we can count, apparently.
Yeah.
Was there a moment where your talent was recognised, either by your parents or yourself? Like, did you have a sense of, hey, I can create just as well as mum can, or
no? No, I mean, I was always, like most kids, you know, I was always drawing when I was small. I mean, that's just something most children do, I think. It's a natural thing.
But there's a tipping point with kids, right, where I've talked about, I can't remember with who now, but I've talked about this in an interview where some children realise that it's this amazing skill they have and they carry on, and others become way too self-conscious of it.
There is that. I don't know. I mean, I drew and... I liked making things as a kid. I mean, I was sort of drawing and painting. And then at school, it was just, I took art at school because couldn't imagine not taking art. It was just a sort of natural thing to do. But I was quite interested in other subjects. I liked science. I liked art history and English. But, you know, the art room at school was always a really interesting place to be. And it felt like a sort of natural habitat.
An extension of home.
Maybe, yeah. And my, you know, closest friends at school took art as a subject and they had parents who had been to art school and were artists. So it was normal to be in this creative environment. I mean, I was really lucky, but I didn't know anything else. It was just how it was.
Yeah. To fast forward maybe a little bit in education, so BFA at Elam, graduating in 1996, and then your MFA at the Slade School of Fine Art at the University of College in London. And of course you're now, you know, conducting a practice basically in the UK.
Yeah.
Did you find much of a difference between the two schools?
Well, it's hard to separate because it was such a, you know, being in a completely different country. You know, everything's different, but somehow everything is the same. You know, you're still focused on making a work, surrounded by people that are also interested in making paintings. I mean, it was, you know, being in London was incredibly exciting.
So a pretty easy transition from...
Easy transition. Yeah, I knew that a bit of London a bit. And in some ways it was really easy to move to a different country and then have this whole structure of an art school to go into. And, you know, you've got all of these people who share a common interest and, you know how art schools work and there's this amazing network. I mean, it's all just there on... It's really easy to slip into.
Yeah.
So it was a, you know, brilliant 2 years.
You clearly possess, like, quite a significant skill as a representational painter, and realise, like, researching for this and looking a lot closely at older work, that that skill's been there for a long time. So I looked at a couple of works, a work called Untitled, a work Untitled, but from 1998.
Yeah.
And then another work called Number 31 that's in the University of Auckland collection from 2000.
Yeah.
You're in your, I guess, late 20s by that stage. Already this, you know, remarkable skill on show. So that level of skill, is that something that's always been present, or have you had to work quite hard, I don't know, as a teenager or in early 20s to establish that skill?
Oh, I think, I remember when I started painting at Elam, I mean, I wasn't even sure if I was going to do painting. I thought maybe I'd do photography. And then I thought maybe I'd do design, but I knew quite quickly that I would have been terrible at that. So painting, I ended up there and I found it really, really difficult. I mean, I still find it really difficult. And I think that that's its appeal, that it's a constant challenge. And that.
What are the difficulties for you? Because it doesn't look difficult. Like, looking at the work, it looks exquisite.
I don't know. I mean, it's and I never know if it's going to work out. Like, it's always a bit, it feels that it's never a given that the painting is going to be, it's going to work. I mean, a lot of paintings fall by the wayside as I'm making them.
So there's a bit of an attrition rate. Not every work sees the light of day.
No, there's quite a high attrition rate. There's a lot of linen that gets chopped up and thrown away. It's expensive.
Yeah,
I think it's, you know, it's something that I've had to learn and, you know, hopefully I'll get better at it one day. I might feel like I know what I'm doing.
But you feel like you must be still, like, do you feel like you're still refining it as a practice?
Oh, God, yeah.
Because it looks like you are.
Yeah. I feel like I'm really, there's a, you know, long way to go. I mean, every time I start painting, it feels like I'm starting from the beginning again. Yeah, it's always, every painting is a challenge and I'm never sure if it's going to work and it's a struggle.
Well, I've also wondered with your practice, again, looking at this really remarkable, highly skilled representational work, whether you're actually approaching work in a bit of an old school way of really wanting to honour, I don't know, you know, masters of Renaissance or High Renaissance or Baroque period painting. So do you feel like you're pulling influence or wanting to honour those guys in the work?
So when I was at Elam, I was really interested in painting of the Spanish Baroque. I'm not sure how this came about, but there were some brilliant books. There's this Spanish artist called Francisco de Cerveran, and I was looking at his work and Velázquez and Ribera. I'd never seen them in the flesh, I think, at this point. You know, I'm still not quite sure what drew me to them. I think it was, you know, the sort of intensity of the focus and the, I mean, they're so beautifully painted. So I was looking at that, and the paintings I was making of drapery came from looking at particularly Zurbaran. I do look at a lot of old painting, and I find it interesting. I mean, I still...
You're enjoying the proximity to them now? Because it's so much easier, presumably, to see them in the UK and London and Europe.
But I don't see them as old paintings. I mean, they're, you know... They're timeless, a lot of them. Yeah.
Well, maybe to that point around those works being timeless, your practice is one, like, of all these conversations that I've had, again, looking at your work in preparation for this conversation, reminded me most of Jude Ray, especially given that both of you seem to be obsessed with light, or give light a really high degree of consideration. So is light really front of mind when it comes to painting?
Yes, I suppose so. I suppose, I mean, some of the paintings, yeah, there's some works I've been have made which have, you know, light shining through windows. You know, I mean, they're paintings of light.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much in my current work, but, you know, the paintings of objects, the way the light falls on these things, and the paintings of, lots of paintings of windows, curtains, and the light through the window. So,
yeah. I always like to throw in, for listener reference, so listener, this is for you, a work that I'll include in the Good Oil Emily Wolf Instagram post, a work called Tall Window from 2015, which I think probably captures perfectly what you're talking about. It's an astonishing painting. Yeah.
I remember that it was a photograph I took of a window in France, I think, in late summer.
That's the subject for that painting of Tall Window?
I think that's the one. You know, it's really beautiful. Light. So yeah, you're right. It probably is the light.
You're maybe not as concerned with light now with the current work, which I'm certainly going to ask you a few questions about. But has it been then that consideration of light a really foundational to the practice, like understanding how light works with objects? And
yeah, although, you know, the Spanish paintings, the light is so fundamental in there. You know, dramatic, darkly lit with these brightly lit subjects and dark, dramatic light. So, and that was probably why I was drawn to them in the first place. So initially, I think that, you're right.
Well, the light aside, the other part of the practice that you seem determined to focus on is the indoors.
Oh, yes.
As space. I think, notwithstanding, and we're going to get to this, that current subject matter is landscape painting.
Indoors.
But yeah, I mean, I think all of the work, except for four or five paintings exhibited in 2016 that were exteriors of, I'm assuming, UK businesses, is indoors. So you're pretty obsessed with the indoors as subject matter, or how light behaves in that space.
Yeah. Well, I spend most of my time indoors. I live somewhere where it's probably, you know, being indoors, the climate's crap.
And living in the UK.
Yeah. I remember when we were at Elam, and the first year of painting, we were set this project. Must have been, maybe it was Don or Don Binney who set this project, and it was a landscape project. And I just couldn't really bring myself to leave the studio to go. We were meant to be, you know, making paintings of landscape. Oh, I just couldn't really tackle that. I was so interested in paintings of objects and still lives. I didn't really know how to grapple with this huge subject. And I think at the time I'd been finding these old bits of china in the garden, and somehow I connected these to the landscape. I started making these little dioramas of the landscape with these pieces of china.
This is when you're still at Elam?
This is when I was at Elam.
Yeah.
And that was my way of getting around this big subject of
Did you get away with it, by the way, at Elam?
I don't, I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe I didn't. I don't know. And I think that sort of stuck. You know, I make these sort of setups in the studio.
Yeah. Because you want to be able to control the environment, like creating something that is still life to work with is more important than the uncontrollable of the outdoors.
Well, it's sort of, I mean, I have an idea of what it is I want to paint. And yeah, I can control the light, so I work from photographs, so I can control the light. Very rarely might I see something out in the world that I can take a photograph of and make a painting from. So yeah, there is a degree of control that I have when I work like this. And I, you know, I mean, I just spend too much time inside.
Yeah. Inside is your natural environment.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Well, that maybe flows into this next question quite well. And I certainly want to talk about current work, but we will get to that, I promise. But for a good, I don't know, 10, 15 years or so of the practice, establishing the practice, you seem drawn to really delicate, intricate material, so lace and cotton.
Mm.
Why the attraction to that as subject material? Because it looks really difficult to paint.
Well, living in London, I was always interested, you know, there's all of these sort of high-density living windows. You're looking through people's windows with curtains and the light coming through them. And my studio looked out onto a building was just all of these windows with these patterned fabrics and the light coming through, particularly in the evening. And the pattern is interesting.
The pattern of, so for example, lace curtains.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sort of a narrative you can have with some of these, I guess, some of these curtains that I can't remember. It seems such a long time ago. But
well, here's one maybe for, again, I meant this for listener reference, but maybe as a reminder to you. There's a spectacular work called, actually untitled, but open bracket, Swans, bracket.
Yeah.
Like extraordinary work from 2011. So that seems to have an odd little narrative in it, like so many of those lace curtain paintings
do. So a lot of these things I find in flea markets, and I'm always looking out for bits and pieces. And I think I found this one day and made, a little setup in my studio.
Oh, so those are often setups, lace curtain paintings.
Yeah.
They're not you exploring different indoor spaces.
No, a lot of them were set up. And that way I can control the light. And there's a certain time of day where the light coming through the window works better. And then you can, sort of the horizon, if there's too much outside, you don't get enough light, you don't get the patterns. So I had a whole lot of sort of setups that I would then photograph and make the paintings from.
Working in a space in Oxford or in
this
London?
This was in London, I think. Yeah. These were all made in London. I had a studio that had these fantastic huge windows which looked out over the city. So, these big windows, it's a real opportunity to make these paintings.
I didn't realise how staged they were. They all look like these brilliant interior spaces.
A few must have been, it seems so long ago now, a few must have been, some were taken at home, various other people's, sometimes a friend had a particularly good window. One of the apartments I lived in had a lovely round oxeye window, and I think I used a sort of climbed up a stairwell and I was always hanging curtains over the inside to photograph these things. So there was a bit of that going on. But I'd have an idea of what it was that I wanted to paint and would set them up rather, because I couldn't go sort of knocking on people's doors and say, look, you've got really interesting.
Yeah. Oh, that is interesting to know, because I, as I say, always looking at these different, all these different lace curtains, I wondered.
Yeah, I had quite a collection of them.
Yeah.
Which I've carried around for...
Oh, you can't give them up.
I just got rid of them. We moved house and I just thought this is, I got to stop hoarding stuff. So I had a big clear out. There, you should have seen the shit that was put out on the street, and people, took it. I think there are these extraordinary net curtains.
That they wanted to go home and paint, maybe. Maybe not. I wanted to talk about a few, what I think are really complementary contradictions in your work.
Mm.
There's a few of them.
Mm.
So I think starting, I've already used the word exquisite, I know, but creating the works that you do that look so exquisite, they're incredibly easy to look at. They're soft and gentle, but looking at them for longer, you realise how much work has to go into them. So they must be enormously difficult and painstaking to make. Lots of tiny marks, lots of layering. So are you trying to hide in plain sight just how difficult it is to make those works?
I don't know. I mean, I make lots of paintings at the same time, so it never feels, and when something becomes too difficult, I will move on to the next painting and come back to it. I mean, I think maybe they've become less laboured. I don't know.
You're finding them easier?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm finding them easier, but I think, maybe some of them have less detail in them, possibly. I mean, the patterned curtain paintings, there was quite a lot of work in that, and, it did towards the... You start to feel like you're going slightly mad. There's repeated patterns over and over. But I don't know. I mean, when you're making them, when I'm making them, you just get lost in it in a way.
So even though they're really hard work, are they meditative as well?
Well, possibly. I mean, time goes quite quickly when it's going well. When it's not, it's the reverse happens. But it is. And, sometimes when you go into the studio and I think, well, today I know that I just have to do this. There's a pattern. It's reassuring. You've got the structure and you think, well, I need to just get this done today. I know exactly what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And that's easier when days where maybe you're starting a painting and it's all you know, you don't quite know what's going to happen or if it's going to work.
The other contradiction I think I see is that there's a great deal of ease and peacefulness and beauty in all of the work. But if I, and maybe this is just me, the longer I look, there's a bit of disquiet and something unsettling about the spaces or the paintings in general as well. So is that, I don't know, contradiction, duality, is that something you intend with the work?
Or is it just how it comes out?
Or is it just how it comes out?
Possibly. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I never quite know if it's going to work, the painting. And somehow, which seems a bit strange given that they're, you know, I work from photograph and, you know, the subject is all there in the beginning.
Well, maybe another way to phrase that question is there a specific narrative that you're wanting to capture in work, even though you're working from photographs? Mm. Is that, you know, that little twist that you want to put on work that has that, I guess, dual experience of something that's beautiful but maybe ends up being unsettling as well?
Uncomfortable. I think so. I mean, I think there needs to be, you know,
tension.
And yeah, you need to have that. Otherwise, I mean, whether or not it's intentional, that's how they come out. But you need to have that duality, I think, in order for them to work. Otherwise, they're
just boring paintings of spaces otherwise.
Yeah, and maybe partly it's because they're so still. There is that.
Well, they almost look, especially some of the older interior spaces, they almost look abandoned. Like there's never really any humans. Well, there's never humans, full stop.
No.
But they feel like spaces that have possibly been abandoned by humans.
Yes, there is that possibly someone's just left the room.
Yeah, a single piece of furniture or...
Yeah. Well, usually the paintings, those ones, paintings of bits of furniture that are found on the side of the road that have just been abandoned to the side of the road. I mean, they're a great one for picking up bits of broken chairs, dragging them home. They sit in the loft for 10 years and then I might think, oh yes, that's interesting.
You see them on the side of the road and they immediately look like good subjects.
They speak to me, yeah.
What are they saying? Take me home.
Yeah. Usually I'm on my, this, you know, usually I'm cycling, so I end up carrying a chair on my bike, you know, and sticking it in the studio, and I end up just with this, you know, corner full of broken things.
Well, this one perhaps isn't so much a contradiction exactly, but I have a sense that you're fascinated by the illusion of painting as well, like taking a, you know, flat two-dimensional picture plane and creating something which often with your work is extraordinarily 3D in representation. So you're fascinated by the illusionary nature of painting too?
Well, because I'm interested in... Are you talking about the paper?
I'm talking about all of your work. I mean, especially the most recent, maybe the most recent work, but there's always so much extraordinary depth to the work.
Yeah, I mean, because I see them all as still life paintings, even the ones that make reference to the landscape. I mean, I think that's what I've always been painting when I was at Elam and I was making these funny China paintings. And, you know, I was just interested in the way these objects sit in space and how you can, you know, how you can create the sense of depth on this flat surface. And I guess particularly with most recent work, you know, I'm dealing with pieces of paper, you know, flat surfaces, but I still see them as objects, you know, three-dimensional objects.
Yeah. There's been a bit of a shift in the last, I suppose, 4 or 5 years, where I know we've talked about this, like all of the work effectively are still life paintings, but you're now in a period where you're treating paintings as still life paintings. Mm. So maybe you've already answered this a little bit, but are they paintings about paintings, or have they just ended up being interesting still life subjects, or a bit of both?
A bit of both, I think. They're paintings of reproductions of paintings that have been collaged and stitched together and come from all over the place.
Well, that might actually be a good point for you to explain what that current process is, because it's quite, I almost use the word convoluted. Yeah. So what does that process look like at the moment? Talk us through that.
Well, it involves lots of photocopies of prints.
Wait, one step back maybe in that. You're presumably being pretty careful about work, like the images that you're selecting to photocopy.
Mm. Well, yes, I am. And so, they're just another example of things that I've found in, charity shops, just old prints of paintings. And some of them printed on really lovely, heavy paper that's a bit foxed
Oh,
and
yeah.
torn. And often the reproductions are terrible, sort of the bits in shadow, there'll be hardly any detail.
But you must be drawn to a specific period of work. Like so Claude Lorrain, as an example, I think is quite often reference material,
Yeah,
right?
yeah. I mean, well, they're the ones that, yes, and they're in a way they're easier to sort of photocopy sections of and use bits of. There's such a structure to those paintings, but the ones that I'm using, the colours are all sort of slightly odd. So the pinks are really pink.
Because of poor reproductions in
Poor
the first place.
reproduction, yeah. And so then I just photocopy bits, and this all started in the pandemic. So sort of had access to not much. We couldn't go anywhere, but I had a photocopier and these old reproductions. And so I was just sort of photocopying chunks of them quite randomly.
So you end up with A4 sizes of
A4,
photocopies, yeah.
yeah. And you might get one that has a little bit of a mountain, a cloud, and it's a branch randomly sticking up into the middle of it. And so I began kind of, I just had these all over my studio floor, sort of collaging them and sticking them together and then putting them on my wall and making paintings from these sort of random bits. But it all, we were talking before about it taking me a long time to, I might pick up a chair on this, on the footpath, and it sits in my studio for 10 years before I do anything about it. So I had these for a long time. But it came about quite a few years earlier. I worked as a trainee archaeologist and then an archaeologist, and it came about from that. I spent a long time thinking about this really interesting experience I'd had, and I wasn't quite sure if I could somehow. I wanted this process of archaeology I wanted to use in my painting, but I wasn't sure how this might come about. And when I started photocopying all of these things and layering bits of paper over the top, I thought, well, this reminds me of the sort of paperwork you'd have left over after some archaeological excavation. You're drawing up these sort of sections of earth on
I
permatrace, and you
see,
layer on
right.
top of each other and you build up this sort of layer of the earth. It's all quite convoluted, and it doesn't really make sense to anyone else, but in my head.
When we were speaking about it a few days ago, you said when you were working as an archaeologist, so in Rome.
No, it was in London. So
Ah.
it was quite a few years ago, the Museum of London, it's called Mola, it's the archaeological commercial wing of the Museum of London. They were looking for. They it took a few of us on as trainee archaeologists. I think there'd just been these huge infrastructure projects in London. Crossrail was a big one.
Oh, yeah.
And they needed all of these archaeologists to work on it. And I think there was a shortage. So they were trying to, encourage people. And I just saw this ad and thought this sounded so interesting.
Is this post MFA?
This is post. So this is. I mean, I was in my 40s. My daughter had just started school.
I see you've been painting for a long time
Been
anyway.
painting for a long time.
Did you think, oh, this might inform the practice in a way,
I
or?
think so, but it was also something I'd always been interested in, and it was specific to London. I don't think I would have done this if I'd been living. I mean, it was because the archaeology is concentrated in the City of London largely, and that's where I was living. And I walked past these big construction sites, and I would see these archaeologists way down there, and I think, oh, this just looks brilliant. So I saw this and thought, this is mad. Let's try it. And they trained us up. It was, theoretical aspect to it. And then we were sent out to work on these big construction sites in the centre of London. And you're working, buildings are being demolished around you, or they're being built, or they're putting. The piling rigs are putting the foundations in, and you're in this small trench with the sides sort of shaking.
I didn't realize this would all be happening so simultaneously.
Yeah, it does. It was, I mean, it was brilliant. It was quite terrifying. It was really full on.
As I say, when we talked about it the other day, you were saying that you also found it I don't recall exactly the word you used, but maybe along the lines of like having centuries of time right in front of you, layered one on top of the other, you'd found that a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, as a reaction to that, whether painting became or has always been a way to be able to exert some control over the world, to slow things down.
Maybe.
Because, you know, your paintings do have a sense of slowness or slowing time down in them.
Maybe. I remember, it's not that, it doesn't quite answer your question, but there was one morning, I remember we were standing in the trench. It had been machine dug, so there was this big digger that dug right down to this Roman layer. We were standing on that, and I remember looking up this section of the trench at the side, and you could see, you know, the Roman layer and the medieval and the 18th century and the Victorian. It was all there in this, you know, side of the trench, and then above it,
hundreds of years in profile,
you know, 2,000 years in a way. And you could see above it the building being constructed and buildings beyond it, so you could almost see into the future. I thought it was a bit like looking at a painting where you'd see it all at once, you know, this sort of expanse of time, and also like a cross-section of a painting, you know, if you look at the layers of the paint. I don't know. I mean, it made sense to me.
So that, yeah, that process of archaeology, again, maybe another contradiction in your practice, because archaeology, removal, discovery, etc. Yours is actually adding layers, i.e. painting is about adding layers. Mm. There's a form of discovery in that painting for you as well, even though it's the reverse?
Yes. Yes, I think so. I mean, when we were, you know, and you're shoveling, I mean, this in London, it was quite a lot of big archaeology. You're not using tiny little trowels, you know. There was shifting heavy London clay. But you become aware of the changes in the earth, and that's a bit like paint. It was like painting with a really big shovel. Really enjoyable.
So do you feel like you transferred that experience back into the studio with these works that you're creating now?
Well, I mean, that's the connection I make with it. But, you know, when I was doing that, I was then going into the studio in the evening and working, and that transition was really difficult. Yeah, I mean, I was making very different work then, but, you know, going from this sort of working on this huge scale.
Because I wondered, again, archaeology, I wondered with that process whether for you there's a kind of, I suppose all archaeology is cultural by definition, but for you whether it was about wanting to resurface older painters. So I mentioned Claude Lorraine before, who seems to be quite a frequently referenced painter for you. Yeah. So was that part of the process as well? Were you thinking, their paintings are paintings, but I really want to resurface this work?
Possibly. I mean, I think it was more that, well, there was one site we were working on, and it had been a Shakespearean theatre. But before that, it had been the site of a priory, and there'd been orchards and, you know, this sort of idyllic, I imagined this idyllic landscape. But what we were working on was just, it was rubble. There was nothing there. And, you know, you're just digging through all of this dirt, and it's impossible to imagine this sort of idyll that had been there. And so you're looking at maps of this area, and you can see this, and then you're layering, when you look at the maps and you're excavating, and you build up this picture of the topography of the landscape. So, you know, in my mind, I'm sort of shoveling this gravel, mud, clay, and thinking about this idyllic landscape. So it's more about the archaeology, I think, than the painting.
I wonder if you, with the paintings, you were then, I don't know, reintroducing that past onto canvas.
Yeah, but also those paintings have been, because by the time I've got them, they've been reproduced, they're reproductions of reproductions of reproductions.
Yeah.
And so they've sort of been lost in this process.
Like working from reproductions, in fact, again, to go over your process again, discovery of image, reproduction, photograph the reproduction.
And make the painting.
What's the value that you, either a value of discovery for yourself, or what's the value in following that process?
Somehow the image gets lost, the original image gets lost, and then sort of rediscovered, turned into something else. all along the way through these different reproductions.
Well, how literal are the reproductions that you're creating then?
It varies. Sometimes they're quite... Well, they're all sort of collaged bits and pieces, so not that literal, I guess. The smaller works, they're definitely sections. So there's one in the show here, which are little reproductions of sort of photocopies of bits of sky, and they're from various paintings, and they're quite literal. Others, they're stitched together.
So there's a degree of creating the right, almost sculpture, to then paint as still life.
I think so. I mean, yes. I mean, I'm looking for something. So I have all of these photocopies, and I'm looking for something in these photocopies.
Yeah.
I'm not often quite sure what it is I'm looking for until I've pulled it together. And the same pieces often appear in different paintings. I might reuse it again and again.
And that's not necessarily image. It might be tone or light or poor reproduction.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, other scraps of paper or permatrace, which is a heavy tracing paper, which is what we would use in the archaeological excavations to draw gridded permatrace to plot these sections.
Well, there's also... Like we've just talked about, you know, the very nature of painting being about adding layers, but in your work there's a great degree of subtraction or obstruction as well. So for listener reference, there's a work in this current show called Off Center that includes a void seemingly like cut out of the canvas of the original work, and then a work a year or two old called Paperwork, which includes two tall ships and an anchorage that have been papered over or edited out with two black strips of paper deliberately taped over the top of them. So what is that subtraction about for you? What are you trying to do with either literally subtracting, cutting pieces out of work, or, as is so often the case with works, adding layers of paper, you know, tracing paper over the top of?
Well, I think some of these, I was thinking about these excavations that I was working on, you know, where you're cutting these trenches into the earth and you're pulling these things out of it. You know, and archaeology is a destructive process. You know, you're digging into the earth, you're pulling these things out, and then it's all backfilled. You know, so there's this destruction that goes on. And then when you look down an aerial view of these excavations, there's all of these rectangular trenches everywhere. So I think I was thinking a lot about that.
Not so dissimilar to all those A4 photocopies that you're layering. So there's a parallel for you of looking at those archaeology sites and all those layers of paintings those layers of photocopies that are sitting on the studio floor.
Yeah. So my studio floor looks a bit like an excavation. The thing that really interested me about the archaeology was at the end of the day, you have, after the excavation, you have the finds, whatever they are. In my case, it was never very interesting. Some bits of Roman pot, maybe some, they were quite lovely, clay pipes, lots of pins, oyster shells, and some, the best day, I think, were these tiny little bits of medieval glass, which were like finding butterfly wings in the clay. Really beautiful.
They're so delicate, you mean. Yeah,
tiny. And so the scale is quite weird. You know, you're on this vast site and you're finding these tiny, tiny things. And then all the finds get bagged up and you're left with a pile of drawings, and the finds go to the specialists and the drawings go somewhere else, and then it's all just sort of filled in. It's like it never existed.
So is there a sense there of wanting to maybe consciously or subconsciously recreate that space with the photocopies layered on top of each other? Because it sounds like you end up looking at your studio floor in the same way you're looking at an archaeology dig.
Yes, that's right. And it looks like that because there's just stuff everywhere, layers and layers. I build up these stacks of paper in my studio and then rearrange them. Yeah.
Rearrange them to what you think you want as a collage.
Yeah.
Then photographing them.
And then photographing them. Sometimes I work directly from the collage. It depends on the light in my studio. At the moment, the light is pretty consistent. And because there's not too much shadow, you're dealing with, you know, pieces of paper on the wall or on the floor. The light doesn't change. So I tend just to work from the sheets of paper. The other thing I was interested in looking at was I was in Rome for a period of time, and I was looking at a lot of Roman frescoes that had been excavated and then reconstructed. This in the Palazzo Massimo, there's a whole, this beautiful room of these reconstructed frescoes. It's like, it's, you know, you're standing inside a painting. It's very beautiful.
Yeah.
And then there are somewhere they're just fragments, and you will have...
also incomplete. The fresco is incomplete, yeah.
Incomplete frescoes. So you have sort of enough information around the side, but the central piece might be missing. But you know what you're looking at because you've got the information on the outside. But they're like these sort of jigsaw puzzles that were put back together. I was really interested in this, you know, these images of these incomplete landscapes. So the central bit is somehow lost time, but you have the, you know, the fragments of it around the outside.
So I wanted to apply the same with your work, like providing either incomplete information or masking, obstructing some of the image. To what, make the viewer work a bit harder, or?
Yes, I mean, you know, you sort of know what you're looking at because I guess these landscapes are so familiar in a way because there's a pattern that they form, you know, the sort of middle ground, the distance, and you can be missing a bit and you can fill that in with your, you know, you just instinctively know how it works. But I was looking at these, was shortly after I'd been doing the archaeology, I became really interested in these fragments of frescoes. And so I think that informs a lot of these paintings.
Yeah. Back to process.
Yes.
So again, that process of image, photocopy, layout, photograph, and then you work from the photograph. You don't work from the original sculpture or still life.
Not usually.
Aren't you creating a rod for your own back there?
Probably.
Because in my mind, I think you treat light so beautifully, that must be so much harder from a photograph. If the light was falling on the sculptural still life that you've created from in the studio, as I say, rod for your own back there, or there's benefit to working from photograph?
Well, the light, because the light changes. I mean, if I've got really, you know, in the winter it's okay. I have a really consistent light. And the studio I'm in at the moment isn't too bad. But I've had studios where you have the light, it's just, it moves around all the time and that makes it really difficult.
Oh, so the photograph is about the photograph, consistent source material.
Yeah, and I know exactly where everything is. And, you know, things fall off the wall or they, you know, I might move them around. So I've got a record of it. So it is easier. It is easier to work from a photograph. And also along the way, detail gets lost. So in the photocopying, you know, you get some nice blurring. The problem with working, so I work from a screen. The problem with that is that you can get too much detail. So I do prefer, if I can, to work from the photocopies rather than the photograph because there's just, you know, infinite. You know, I can zoom in and that's when it starts to become quite hard work because I don't know where to stop.
Well, again, I suppose there's another important piece of editing there for you. For how much detail do I include? Because they're incredibly detailed works anyway.
How much is it? But often the detail that you need seems to be missing. You know, there'd be a crucial bit, sort of a tree trunk that has been completely lost. I mean, I used to work from photographs, but once they became digital photographs, then the quality changed. You know, old analog photographs that I would get blown up, there was nice blurring in there, a softness to them. They were lovely to work from.
Which you're not anymore. You're not going to the trouble of analog photographs.
It became too difficult to do that. I couldn't find places that would.
Yeah.
So then when it became digital, the quality changed and I just thought, well, I may as well just be working...
from the photocopies.
Yeah, from my photocopies.
So there is a bit of a catch there with photographs where they can actually be too good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, photographs that are too good, I always find don't make such good paintings.
Yeah.
It's the crap photographs that I like, the ones with this information missing, it's a bit blurred. that they usually make the better paintings.
Yeah.
Mm.
So is the imperfect actually quite important? You look at your paintings and they look like these really rich, beautiful, high degree of representational work, but the imperfect's actually quite important for you. It's the interesting.
Yeah, yeah, it's the interesting bit. It's the interesting bit. Yeah, the blurry bits, the bits around the edge.
The missing bits of the fresco.
The missing bits, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So a few technical questions. You prefer to paint with oils. Well, why oils as a preferred medium?
They're slower drying. It gives me time to think about the work.
Ah.
You know, I can do something and the next morning I come back into the studio and if it doesn't look right, I can still manipulate it. I know roughly how they're going to dry. The colours will look the same when they dry.
Again, consistency.
Consistency, and, yeah. And, you know, it has a depth that, I mean, maybe you can get it with really good acrylic paints, but, I mean, that's just what I'm used to. I like the consistency of it. It's buttery. It's
funny you say gives you time to be able to manipulate because I thought, given the degree of layering that you do and how much detail there is, I thought it might drive you bananas that it does take so long to dry.
It does take a long time to dry. I mean, that's why I've got lots of paintings on the go at the same time.
Yeah, right.
And I always seem to work in the winter, so it's really slow. You know, it takes a couple of days, depending on the humidity in my studio. I've just discovered dehumidifiers, which does speed things up
right. A bit. Takes away some of the anxiety of, am I going to get these paintings finished for a show in time?
I've always used oil paint. I couldn't imagine switching now.
Yeah.
It's too late now.
Yeah. Well, and those, because transparency is a key part of what the practice is about, or certainly from a technical point of view, the construction of paintings. So I'm assuming you've just got really good at understanding the exact weight of thin washes and how to apply them to presumably on top of an image you've already painted.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think about it much. I mean, I've been doing it for so long now, I suppose.
Second nature.
It's second nature. And, you know, you roughly know that something has, it's very lean, you need to put a bit more oil in on the next layer and build it up that way.
Also, those transparent layers might be layered as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very thin paint.
For you to be able to work as finely as you do, it needs to be all thin paint.
Yeah, I like the paint to be quite liquid. Yeah, there's a lot of solvent that goes into it. It used to be white spirit, but now that that's very bad for you, I've had to switch to healthier. I mean, it's just the same. It's just I can't smell it.
So I get a tough time working in the studio when it's...
Well, I get... Yeah, I think I was saying before, I get painter's cough, I think, from breathing in the solvent. But that's just part of the job, really.
Also wanted to ask about palette, because your palette from day one, really... feels quite muted.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether that is in part that want to create that tension that we talked about before in works.
Mm.
I also wondered whether it was just a byproduct of working under English, in English light. So yeah, why is the palette muted?
Muted. It doesn't seem that way to me. I mean, I'm always surprised when I see the works in here.
And by the way, when we say in here, we're sitting at Melanie Roger Gallery in amongst your latest show. So so they look different once they're actually on a gallery wall.
The light, the colours are different. They're definitely more muted here than I think in my studio in London. They look quite vibrant.
You think you're kind of painting quite bright paintings?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but they're not, I wouldn't call them muted. But when I see them here, the tone is different. I mean, the light changes them. But it is a limited palette. And that's just, it's just habit more than anything. But that started at art school and I've just kept the same.
So it's not a deliberate move to try and create a sense of subjects being lost to time and fading?
I mean, maybe, possibly it is, but it's not conscious one. But like I said, I don't see them as being particularly muted. I know it's a small tonal range.
So last question that I tend to ask everyone, removing any limit of budget or whether a work is held in a public institution, what work or artist work would you love to live with?
I've thought about this a lot and I've changed my mind so many times.
It's a tough question.
It's a tough question. Today's choice is Hammershøi, who's a Danish painter. And there's a really beautiful painting called Sunlight. It's in the Tate. It was made in about 1906. He made a lot of paintings in his studio, of his studio, his house in Copenhagen. And this is a painting just with light coming through the window and falling on the floor. And they're quite melancholy paintings. There's a very small tonal range. They're quite chilly and sort of slightly mysterious. There's a lovely one in the National Museum in Denmark. I think it's called Interior with a Stove or something like that. It's got an old stove in the corner and you're looking through a doorway into another doorway. They're really beautiful.
As always, thanks for listening. Emily's current show, Long Distance, is available to view at Melanie Roger Gallery on Kay Road in Auckland until the 27th of June. Or if you're in the United Kingdom, she has a show with Benjamin Parsons Gallery in Oxford in November. Otherwise, contact Melanie Roger Gallery, Page Galleries, or Benjamin Parsons for available work. Please join me for episode 24 of The Good Oil. Until then, ka kite anō.